This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we saw an increase of peaceful protest in different countries. We've also seen a backsliding from government in terms of political and civic space.
Karini Kaniza Nanatulia of Human Rights Watch at the launch of the group's report on Africa. Details coming up also. Parts of Africa are under attack by crop-raking locusts. And Germany will try to nurture the next effort to break the stalemate between the warring factions in Libya. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Was a year of mass protests on the African continent, with demonstrators filling the streets in the capitals like Conakry, Harare, Khartoum, and Kinshasa. While the causes of their grievances varied, the protesters shared one unfortunate characteristic: a harsh response from security forces. VOA's Anita Powell brings us this report from Johannesburg.
There was rage across the African continent last year, says Human Rights Watch in its annual report, with no sign of cooling down. Anger at entrenched leaders in Guinea and Sudan, poor economy in Zimbabwe, and over conflict displaced people in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Ethiopia. But the public outrage is good to see, said the rights group's Africa Advocacy Director, Karine Kaneza Nantulia, at the launch of the report in Johannesburg.
We've seen, I think, the average men and women of the African continent taking agency, being agents for their own, for the changes they wanted to see. We saw an increase of peaceful protest in different countries. The second, I think, takeaway is that we've also seen a backsliding from government in terms of political and civic space.
In some countries in Southern Africa, that meant police aggression and repression, says Human Rights Watch. Dewa Mavinga is the rights group's Southern Africa researcher.
We expected more from Southern African leaders, including President Ramaphosa of South Africa, based on their commitments and promises to fulfill people's rights across the region. But we saw that there was a constriction of space for human rights defenders. In countries like Zimbabwe, there was a clampdown on protesters, excessive use of force by the police and the other arms of the security forces. There was no accountability whatsoever.
But there was also hope, as Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize for liberal reforms and making peace with arch-enemy Eritrea. Babatunde Olugboji is Human Rights Watch's Africa Deputy Advocacy Director.
He's done quite a few great things in Ethiopia. He's released political prisoners. He's actually reforming some repressive laws. He sort of made peace with Eritrea. So things are moving in the right direction, mostly. There's still a lot to be done in Ethiopia.
South Africa takes over the African Union's rotating chairmanship this year, notes Human Rights Watch's Southern Africa researcher, Mavinga. With the continent's most progressive constitution, South Africa's leadership raises some expectations, he says.
South Africa has to step up to the plate. It has to deliver on human rights and draw back on Mandela's legacy. But we will have to continue to push.
And as 2019 made clear, African people will be behind them, demanding their rights and that their voices be heard. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Parts of Africa are under attack. Crop-wrecking insects ravaged Somalia and Ethiopia before recently migrating to Kenya. As VOA's Arash Arbasadi reports, authorities there now race to crush the invaders before they consume crops, harming the nation's food security.
A biblical plague of free-roaming locusts poses an existential threat to crops in parts of East Africa. Kenyan Agriculture Minister Mwangi Kianjuri.
The first swarm crossed the border into Kenya from Somalia on 28 December 2019. Other swarms continued coming in from Ethiopia.
These desert locusts are part of the grasshopper family. They pose such a danger to crops that the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, calls the invasion the Horn of Africa's worst situation in 25 years.
We recognize that the pest invasion and potential to spread rapidly to other counties pose an unprecedented threat to food security and livelihoods in the country.
Out of desperation, local authorities tried everything from spraying tear gas to shooting the insect out of the sky. Now, Kianjuri says the government loaded pesticides aboard aircraft to spray swarm areas, but there is still much to do.
Fighting this invasion is not without challenges. First, there are transboundary pests that must be fought through a regional strategy. Unfortunately, because of insecurity in some of our neighboring countries, it has been difficult to fight and prevent their migration.
The FAO calls the risk low for locust breeding in Kenya. They found some 70,000 hectares of neighboring land infested in December. Swarms can travel 130 kilometers per day, be a kilometer wide, and contain as many as 80 million locusts. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Germany will try to nurture the next effort to break the stalemate between Libya's UN-sponsored government and the Libyan National Army, LNA, and end the North African country's civil war. The LNA's commander, Khalifa Haftar, walked out of a planned signing ceremony Tuesday for a formal ceasefire between the warring parties. Military sources close to the LNA's general command said Haftar rejected the agreement due to the absence of a timeline for dismantling militias and his rejection of Turkey as an international mediator. The LNA announced it would not withdraw from the territories it had conquered in Tripoli's outskirts and that it is determined to free Libya from militias and terror groups. Germany will host a meeting in Berlin on Libya Sunday, with invitations going out to the United States, Russia, China, France, Italy, United Kingdom, Turkey, Egypt, and others. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the latest developments in Libya with William Lawrence, professor of political science at American University.
Well, first of all, talking about dismantling of militias is putting the cart before the horse, because you're talking about the after war before the war has come to an end. And the militias have already learned that when they disarm and turn their weapons over and become part of the regular military forces, they're not able to defend their territory if the war breaks out again. The other problem is that Turkey was a mediator. They went to the talks with Turkey as a mediator. So then to turn around and say that Turkey can't be a mediator is a real problem. But the big problem is that Russia as a mediator has egg on its face. And there are a lot of indications coming out of Moscow that Russia was very upset with Turkey not signing the truce deal and extending the ceasefire. This is the fourth time that Haftar has walked out of a concluded deal or a deal in the making. And the result of this is that Europe will be playing a larger role than before. We had a moment where Turkey and Russia were sort of in charge of things, but it's going to revert back to Europe and the United Nations.
Sarraj met in Turkey with the American ambassador there. Is that an indication that the U.S. would play a role in Libya's conflict?
Well, all the Libya experts would like the U.S. to play a larger role. And there are these moments, particularly with the new U.S. ambassador, where it looks like they might. And certainly the United States was in support of anything that gets us towards peace, whether the Russia or Turkey-led deal or the European-led deal. But whether or not the U.S. will put more sustained diplomatic effort in towards peace remains to be seen. And part of the job of the U.S. ambassador is to keep the White House and Trump from making unhelpful comments along the way and sticking to the playbook.
The LNA announced that it would not withdraw from the territories it had conquered in Tripoli's outskirts and that it is determined to free the entire Libyan soil from militias and terror groups. Egypt is backing Haftar's role in dismantling militias. What could that lead to?
Well, this is just a restatement of Haftar's war aims with the falling apart of the truce negotiations. But what it will mean also is that Russia may step back temporarily from helping Haftar because of what happened in Moscow. And this will mean that the UAE and Egypt will have to step into the breach and increase its support temporarily until the Russians, inevitably come back later to reestablish their support for Haftar. And there's a lot of indications we have that just before he left Moscow, Haftar was in touch with the Emiratis and the Egyptians to make sure they would back him through this process. And the real problem here is that an arms race begins. We were all hoping that the truce would prevent significant escalation in the numbers of arms flowing into the country, but that will increase as a result of this.
Germany is planning a conference on Libya this coming Sunday. Under what circumstances could such conference be the start of a longer process to reach a political solution in Libya?
For many months, we were planning a Libya conference in Berlin of all of the external actors. And when we had the ceasefire last week and the truce negotiations, suddenly Merkel said this is a Libya peace conference with the Libya protagonists involved in actually turning a truce into a longer-term deal. Now we're back to the original plan where the Libyans are invited sort of as observers and the external powers are trying to come to agreement with their external support for a peace process. And that is unfortunate, but the prospects for peace just got further away as a result of what happened in Moscow. Over time, it will depend on consensus among the external backers to support a common deal rather than the two sides in the conflict, and serious negotiations between the Libyan sides rather than just the type of war rhetoric which has kept this civil war going for 4 years.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at American University, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The UN Refugee Agency is appealing for $447 million to provide essential aid for more than 900,000 refugees in Sudan and for nearly 250,000 Sudanese hosting them. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency is teaming up with more than 30 other partners to provide the refugees with shelter, health, education, and other crucial aid for survival. The vast majority of refugees are from South Sudan. But the agency says resources also are needed for refugees from 9 other countries who have fled violence and persecution. In the meantime, UNHCR spokesman Baba Balor says Sudan continues to receive new refugees, putting more pressure on diminishing resources.
In Darfur, an ongoing influx of refugees from Central African Republic into remote parts of Sudan and Central Darfur states has seen the number of refugees swell from just over 5,000 to nearly 17,000 in the 3 months since September 2019.
All this is occurring at a time when Sudan is going through an historical political transition. In April, Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir was ousted after nearly 30 years in power. The UNHCR reports transitional authorities are struggling to achieve peace and stability while mired in a severe economic crisis and faced with an internally displaced population of 1.8 million. Balash tells VOA, refugees in Sudan are scattered over 130 locations across the country's 18 states, some in very remote areas.
They live side by side among their hosts. Sudanese have been sharing resources with the refugees. We need to keep our continued support with the refugees that are in Sudan, but also their hosts who also live on scarce resources.
UNHCR operations in Sudan tend to be greatly underfunded. Last year's appeal for $269 million received only 32% of that amount. The agency is appealing to the international community to be more generous this year and provide the money needed to aid an ever-growing number of destitute people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. 1 year ago, the Al-Shabaab militant group attacked a hotel, an office complex in Nairobi, killing 21 people. A year has passed, but the memory of that day still haunts those who survived. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Juliet will never forget January 15, 2019. She says early that day she had planned to call her sister, who worked in Dusit D2 office complex.
At that particular day, I was like, and I was going to call her, but because of where I was, I couldn't call. So I said, once I'm done is when I'll give her the call. Little did I know that was not to happen.
Juliet, who asked that we use an alias, tried to call her sister when she learned that gunmen had opened fire inside Dusit D2, but the call did not go through. She went to the complex and paced nervously through an area near the attack in search of her sister, hoping she was a survivor. 12:30, she feared the worst.
So when we got to Chiromo, so the attendant was like, we can't allow you to see the bodies now until tomorrow because we need to do a few things and whatnot. But I was like, please, I'm a sister to maybe one of the deceased, but just let me see whoever is there. I was a bit hesitant. Then there were already some security guys who had already come. So one of them told the guy, no, just let them see. If there's someone there that's theirs, let them just see, then they'll confirm. So that's when we're allowed to see. So when we saw, we identified it was her.
Juliet's sister was one of the 21 people killed by Al-Shabaab attackers who stormed the complex. Kenyan security officers engaged the attackers for 20 hours before ending the siege. At the end of the attack, at least 1,000 people escaped with their lives. June Chepkemei survived the attack. She was attending a conference in the hotel when they heard sounds of explosion and gunfire. She and six others hid in one of the hotel rooms.
I think it was around 5 p.m. Before that, we had several bangs at the door. And we had been told that any bank don't open, those are actually the tourists. And we had several of such banks. But we were told the security personnel who are coming to our rescue will not knock. They will simply break and secure you. So at some point at around 5, the door was broken and a team of rescuers, a huge battalion, walked in and they came and rescued us. And they took us down the stairs. Step by step, we were still hearing shootings all over the place.
Ronald Ngeno survived the attack and went back to work in the complex, but the place has never been the same for him.
Immediately after the attack, they increased the security a lot, and right now we feel very secure. However, most of us don't feel comfortable. For example, to go and have lunch or have meals at the places where we know people were killed.
Kenyan authorities were praised for reacting to the terror attack quickly, unlike the Westgate Mall attack in 2013, where 67 people were killed. Kenyan security agencies made dozens of arrests. Some were released after interrogation. Mustafa Ali is a Horn of Africa security analyst.
The government now need to focus a lot of their attention to prevention and ensuring that radicalization into extremism that leads to recruitment by Al-Shabaab among the Kenyan population is reduced, is prevented, and stopped.
So far, six people accused of playing roles in the Dusit D2 attack are awaiting trial. Meanwhile, Al-Shabaab continues to carry out attacks in the northeastern and coastal regions of Kenya. In less than a week, Al-Shabaab fighters attacked two schools in Garissa County, killing four students and three teachers. The terror group wants Kenya to leave Somalia. These African nation troops are part of the African Union force fighting Al-Shabaab and providing support to the Somali government. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Schools in Zimbabwe have opened after the year-end break, but most teachers aren't there due to a deadlock with the government over pay. Teachers say the economic decline has dramatically reduced the buying power of their salaries, and they want their pay pegged to the US dollar. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has the details.
The build-up to schools opening for another education term has been tense. Teachers urged government to review their salaries and peg them against the interbank foreign exchange market. Raymond Majongwe is the Secretary General of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
Those that we know have not gone to school, and our point is very clear. Teachers are not on strike, we are incapacitated. We can't go and borrow money from moneylenders to go to work. We can't subsidize the government. Teachers are not at work, and if they are there, they are not working.
Teachers, as well as other government employees, say that soaring inflation has eroded their salaries so far that they cannot afford to travel to work and are thus incapacitated. Over the past few years, Zimbabwe's economy was weakened sharply, with shortages of everything from cash to food to fuel, in addition to inflation. The problems have been worsened by a prolonged drought that has cut harvests and has reduced the output at hydropower dams. On Monday, the government announced cushioning allowances for civil servants as negotiations for salaries continue. The talks have dragged longer than expected, and last Friday, the Apex Council representing government workers turned down a 97% salary increase. Majongwe says the cushion allowances work against civil servants.
It's an insult. It doesn't address anything. In actual fact, it actually exacerbates and entrenches us into more poverty.
In the recent past, any allowance or salary increase has influenced price hikes. As a result, teachers and other civil servants want their salaries indexed against the interbank market exchange rates. Obed Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe.
We encourage the government to urgently intervene and resolve the salary crisis so that at least we have our teachers back to school. We want the best for our public schools because this is the only way we can ensure that education is accessed by the ordinary poor people.
He adds that the negotiations are pointless and government should comply with the demands of the teachers. He vows that until government agrees to index salaries against the interbank market, then there will be no learning in schools. Parents feel cheated in all this. They struggled in the harsh economic climate to pay school fees and get supplies for their children to return to school. But now their children will not be learning. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuib in Washington. Please stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Bill Andrade, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, slavery, racism and colonialism fueled the emergence of Pan-Africanism. Reflections on the significance of Pan-Africanism on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.